Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and all around the Internet. To those who have joined us, welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitutional Leadership Initiative. Today I have with me our regular contributors, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, and Mr. Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. We have a unique show lined up this morning. We're taking on one of the most controversial topics in America today, Kim Davis and the rule of law. Was Ms. Davis right to deny issuing marriage licenses to both homosexual and straight couples? Did she break the law in doing so? And if so, which law? Of course, these are just the most visible questions. Of greater urgency is this question. Is the Supreme Court opinion in Obergefell versus Hodges the, quote, law of the land? And if so, on what basis does a Supreme Court opinion become law? The Kentucky state constitution still today defines marriage as between a man and a woman, and Ms. Davis took an oath to support and defend that constitution as well as the United States Constitution. Is that what she's doing? Our intrepid commentators hope to address these questions and more this morning, and I've designated the last 15 minutes of the show for your call-in questions and comments. So whether you're hearing this over radio or over the Internet, starting at 7:40 this morning, you'll be able to call in and give us a question or a comment. The call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And the first caller of the morning will receive in the mail a nifty pocket constitution. I think the previous owner was Senator Harry Reid, so you know it's in never-read condition. Please do not call in until 7:40 because there's no reason to keep the lines tied up till then. Once our commentators have had their say, you'll have your chance, I promise. If the lines are tied up, you can also email us a question by sending it to production at 1180WFYL.com. This morning I'm wearing a We the People t-shirt that says, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Quite appropriate saying this morning, which our regular listeners will recognize as coming from none other than our founding father and second president, John Adams. You can get your own copy of this particular shirt by going to www.wethepeopleT-shirts.us. Mine's actually getting a little ragged. I may have to go shopping soon. So let's get started. I'm going to start by asking Pastor David Whitney to help us understand just what is law, what categories of law exist, and to whom does our Constitution provide the power to make law? David, tell us.
Oh, thank you, Gary. If this wasn't radio, I'd say that's a beautiful T-shirt. You should all see it. Well, law actually originated at the creation of man. When God made man, he promulgated the very first law. It was a spoken law, not a written law, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it. So God gave a negative commandment, as well as he gave positive commandments, that they were to tend the garden, that they were to be fruitful and multiply. So the law begins with God himself. In fact, he is the origin of all true law, and our founders clearly understood a distinction between true law and what they called in the Declaration of Independence pretended legislation. That is, some legislature somewhere spills ink on a piece of paper and then they pass it on to the executive branch, and we say, well, the executive branch signs it into law, and then in our system of government, at least, we expect the judicial branch to weigh in on this supposed legislation to say, well, yes, this is law or this is not law. But the judiciary is supposed to weigh in based upon the standard that goes all the way back there to the Garden of Eden. Law comes from God. That is, legitimate law is in accordance with how he created the universe. Our founders clearly stated there is a creator God. We are not evolved. The universe did not evolve. It did not come into existence on its own. And that creator established all the laws of the universe. So we have, for example, all the physical laws. Laws of gravity and mathematics and chemistry, and wow, if you disobey those laws, there's an immediate response from the creation that punishes you for disobeying those physical laws of the universe. Well, the moral laws that God has promulgated are just as unchangeable and fixed, even though the penalties for violating those laws are not always as immediate as violating the physical laws of the universe. So our founders understood what the scripture said, that every human being, because we're created in God's image, every human being has God's law written upon their heart. In fact, that's what the Apostle Paul describes in Romans chapter 2, verse 15, speaking about non-believers. They demonstrate that God's law is written in their hearts, for their own conscience and thoughts either accuse them or tell them they are doing right. So every human being is born with a conscience. Now, they may deaden that conscience so that it no longer functions and operates the way the Creator designed it. And this idea that every human being has God's law written within them is what our founders called natural law. So in the Declaration of Independence, when they said the laws of nature, the first part there of that phrase, the laws of nature, refers to this idea from the Garden of Eden and repeated by the Apostle Paul in Romans 2:15. Every human being knows right from wrong. We could do a little experiment. We could take the globe, spin it, put our finger down on any piece of dry land, put a parachute on our back, fly a plane over that particular location, parachute into any culture, any language, any place with any history whatsoever, and as the parachuter, when you get your parachute off your back, go find the very first human being you can find and grab whatever they're holding in their hand and begin to run away from that person. It doesn't matter what culture, it doesn't matter what language, that person is going to come running after you. Why? They know the law of God that says, thou shalt not steal. They know the law regarding property rights. It's written on the heart, regardless of their culture, regardless of their history, background, or language. They know the law of God written within their heart, even if they violate that law of God. So that natural law is the first form of law that we must measure. Anything that is called legislation, anything that claims to be law, has to be measured against that. However, we know that human beings choose often to violate their conscience, or they choose to ignore the conscience, or perhaps even deaden the conscience so they no longer hear its voice. So human conscience is not a very accurate measure of what is right and wrong many times. And therefore, God in his mercy chose to give us a written record so that what's written on our heart, if we try to erase it and stamp it out, God has given us a written record in his word, the Bible. And that is the law of revelation. All of our founders read William Blackstone. William Blackstone clearly stated this three forms of law. There's the law of nature we've just talked about, the human conscience, human reason, human understanding. And then there's the revealed law given to us in the word of God. And this revealed law by our founders in the Declaration of Independence, they paraphrase this, the laws of nature's God. That phrase in our declaration, which is the foundation of our civil government, the very reason for why our country came into existence, based upon the laws of nature and nature's God. That second phrase refers to the Bible. And so the second standard, revealed law or divine law, is given to us in the Bible. So any human law that somehow contravenes or contradicts or goes against the revealed law of God given to us in the Bible, again, is not law. So if any body of people, even if it's a state legislature or even if it's the majority of the people in a particular locale, put forth a law that violates God's law, that is not law. So Roe v. Wade, even if it was properly adjudicated and properly legislation and so forth was taking place, the right for a woman to supposedly murder her baby? No. God's law says, thou shalt not murder. Absolute, final, unchanging, any human law that disagrees with that law is really no law at all. Now, Blackstone added that there's a third category of law, and he called it municipal law, and that which men put to paper themselves. And Blackstone added, and our founders all believe this, that municipal law, that human law, is only valid if it complies with the first two standards, the laws of nature and nature's God. Therefore, what we have going on in Kentucky is a very interesting scenario because it was claimed that the Supreme Court somehow made law when they said that two men can marry. Go back to the first standard, the laws of nature. Can two men marry? Almost everyone in the universe knows that's not possible because you'd be rewriting the laws of the universe. You'd be saying that 2 plus 2 no longer equals 4 or the laws of chemistry no longer are what they are. Somehow human beings can rewrite law. I'd like to see a legislature, I'd like to see the Supreme Court say that they're going to spill ink on a piece of paper and suspend the law of gravity. And I'd love to see them test this out by climbing to the top of, the highest building in Washington or the highest building in any city and try it out. Jump off that building and see if your ink on a piece of paper has actually changed the laws of the universe or not. Here's our problem. What we have is men who think they are God. That is, they think they can overcome the God who created the universe, and they can do what they please because they are God. Now, it's very interesting. It's only the Supreme Court that thinks they are God. You and I, the average citizen here, we don't get the power to do that. So how is it that if all human beings are created equal, which our Declaration clearly states and which every detail of our Constitution and Bill of Rights is designed to support that idea, that all men are created equal, how is it that the Supreme Court gets to be above the rest of us? How is it that they get to be God, but we do not get to be God? And I think this rankles in the hearts of Americans all across our land today, and I think it is a good thing that we're seeing pushback. Kim Davis should be just one of thousands and thousands of citizens who in positions that have been elected by the people who've sworn an oath to uphold the law, that is, the laws of nature, the laws of nature's God, our U.S. Constitution, of course, their state constitution, that they would push back and say, sorry, the Supreme Court does not make supreme law. There is a supreme ruler of the universe, and that is the God of the Bible. His law is what we will follow because we've sworn an oath to uphold the law. And whatever the Supreme Court spills on paper, if it's not in agreement with the laws of nature and nature's God, it is not law. And we are not obligated to follow the rantings of someone who thinks they are God when we clearly know they are not God.
Well, that's a great rundown, David, and thank you for that. It puts it in perspective for us. Of course, part of the problem today is that the definition of marriage has changed, or at least is trying to be changed, from a covenantal relationship with God between the man and the woman to just some legal relationship of two people living together. And, of course, that's not what the Bible describes as marriage, and that's not God's idea. So let's move on then to Kim Davis's action. She's been accused by some of being insubordinate for refusing to issue licenses. And in fact, her office was stopping issuing licenses to both homosexual applicants as well as straight applicants. And then she was, we know, jailed for contempt of court for stating that she could not comply. She could not go back to her office and begin issuing those licenses. So was she really insubordinate? Well, that kind of speaks to the issue of civil disobedience, and we know that there's a rich history there, not just in America, but elsewhere. How does civil disobedience fit into this situation? Phil Duffy?
Well, rather than provide a survey of civil disobedience in the United States, which would be a very, very long show, by the way, I'll just give a couple of illustrative examples and make a few comments about the history of disobedience thinking over the past centuries, because that suggests when civil disobedience is appropriate. My comments will not be restricted to the territorial boundaries of the United States, by the way, because I think one of the best examples of disobedience arises from the inferno of World War II and the subsequent Nuremberg tribunals in which the United States representatives played a major role. Our nation's founding reveals us to have been, at one time, a disobedient people. Any student of American history is familiar with the Stamp Act, the Navigation Acts, the tarring and feathering of British revenue agents, Yankee smuggling, and ultimately the resistance to British arms at Lexington and Concord. And all of that is what the founding generation felt was just in the face of unjust laws. It was all about rejection of illegal, tyrannical authority, what Jefferson called a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution. And that disobedience was formalized in the Declaration of Independence, which sought to show that the disobedience had a moral basis. Man-made law, so-called positive law, had contradicted the natural law. Therefore, we were free to throw off the previously acknowledged authority and create a new structure of law anchored in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And we tried twice to create the formal structure, rejecting the British idea of an unwritten constitution, which we believed would lead to a tyrannical legislative branch of government. And we opted instead for written constitutions, and in 1789 ratified our own constitution. Our subsequent history seems to be a contradiction of opposites, however. We're simultaneously law-abiding and a disobedient people. And I'm not talking about the disobedience of obvious criminals who reject society's traditional rules against aggression of all kinds. I'm really talking about people like Martin Luther King and the freedom riders who disobeyed unjust laws, a man-made law that violated the natural law. Whereas there is almost unanimous agreement on the justification of our disobedient actions when we separated from the British crown, that agreement does not hold in the post-founding period to the present. For example, state nullification of unconstitutional federal laws, which is a class of disobedience on kind of a grand scale, even today is applauded by some and opposed by others. Incidentally, my comments will focus primarily on civil disobedience of individuals as opposed to state nullification, which we've discussed in an earlier show. So to demonstrate my point about changing views on civil disobedience, let's consider the treatment given to Henry David Thoreau's resistance to civil government, which influenced Leo Tolstoy, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. That was mandatory reading when I was in high school. And several years ago, I was teaching American government to a group of high school seniors in a homeschool program. None of them had heard of the book. Perhaps the best illustration of the sustainability of support for civil disobedience comes out of our nation's slavery period. I suspect that today there is greater sympathy for John Brown than there is for nullification efforts of Kentucky and Virginia during John Adams' administration. And yet, John Brown's actions were violent, while the latter's were passive. The Kentucky and Virginia resolutions were essentially about abstract principles of government, whereas John Brown's raid was simply about the moral issue of resistance to slavery. Now, note the contradiction between the general principle that good ends do not justify evil means and the practical application of that principle in this case. We get another example in the case of Joshua Glover, who was charged by a federal marshal with being a runaway slave in Wisconsin in 1854. Sherman Booth, a local anti-slavery newspaper editor, whipped up the crowd, which broke into the jail and set Glover free. The federal judiciary attempted to prosecute Booth, but he was freed by a state court. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court demanded that Booth be turned over to federal custody. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court refused to cooperate, and the Wisconsin legislature passed a resolution similar to the Kentucky resolutions of 1798, indicating that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision was null and void in Wisconsin. There are two related lessons to be taken from the Booth and other disobedience cases. The first is, when you undertake civil disobedience, you undertake great personal risk. Second, to reduce that risk, assure that you are on sound moral ground, and that is that your actions are consistent with natural and or revealed law. We can think of other cases of civil disobedience in our nation's history, some successful and others unsuccessful, but I suggest that the concept of obedience to authority is changing as the dominant form of government has evolved from feudalism through monarchical national state and finally to the concept of sovereign people, which was confirmed when the United States successfully separated from Great Britain. Now, Alexis de Tocqueville has a marvelous description of this evolution in democracy in America. Until the concept of government by the people had evolved, failed disobedience was treated harshly as treason, often accompanied by death. That is a long way from the outcomes of the Nuremberg tribunals in 1946, when we hung Germans for failing to be treasonous to a Nazi regime that had come to power through a legitimate election process in 1933. So what had changed? The defendants at Nuremberg defended their actions, as repulsive as they were, because they were only following orders. Their prosecutor was Robert Jackson, who was on leave of absence from the Supreme Court of the United States. The tribunal found the most of the top Nazis guilty, and a number were hung. The principles of the Nuremberg tribunals are today embedded in our judicial thinking. Perhaps that thinking is most explicitly stated in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which makes it clear that military personnel need to obey the lawful command of a superior officer and only lawful orders. Indeed, military personnel have an obligation to disobey unlawful orders, including orders by the president that do not comply with the Uniform Code. The moral and legal obligation is to the United States Constitution and not to those who would issue unlawful orders, especially if those orders are in direct violation of the Constitution and the Uniform Code. So the challenge for an individual citizen is not to obey or disobey, but to know when either is appropriate. Nor is this a matter of the majority being right. And John Stuart Mill has a marvelous quotation on this subject. If all mankind minus one were of one opinion and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. So as Pastor David mentioned earlier, we must consider our conscience and reveal law to determine when we challenge authority and participate in civil disobedience.
Well, that's a great rundown, Phil, and thank you for that. Thinking of Martin Luther King, of course, his movement was successful because I think he really struck a chord with the people. He based his whole movement on the Bible, and his letter from Birmingham jail should be required reading, I think, by every freedom-loving American. What would happen today if we had a march on Washington over this homosexual marriage issue, the size of Martin Luther King's movement? I think we'd see some big differences. Well, we're going to take a commercial break here, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about the First Amendment, and then we're going to open up the phone lines to your comments and questions. So be ready to dial 610-539-8255, and we'll see you in a few moments.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lillian Wu. It's been 14 years since the 9/11 attacks and this vow from President George W.
The United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
Today, our nation remembers.
A ceremony at the National September 11th Memorial and Museum in Lower Manhattan will include 6 moments of silence to mark the times each plane hit the towers, twice to mark the time when each tower fell, and to mark the moments of the attacks on the Pentagon and Flight 93.
Fox Radio's Tanya J. Powers. A memorial to the attacks in Kansas City, Missouri, allegedly the target of a bomb plot by a 20-year-old Florida man. Authorities say Joshua Ryan Goldberg provided bomb-making information to an FBI informant who was posing as an online associate. Fox News, we report, you decide.
A nation of well-informed men who have been taught to know and prize the rights which God has given them cannot be enslaved. It is in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins. A quote from Benjamin Franklin.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back. Welcome back to We the People, The Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, and we're talking about Kim Davis and the rule of law. We've talked about the aspects of law that govern our country, the different categories of law, and how those stack up in terms of a supremacy with natural law being at the top, revealed law, also directly from God, and then civil law, which must comport with the first two to be of validity. And then we talked a little bit about civil disobedience and whether Kim Davis's actions are, in fact, being disobedient to a law or perhaps obedient to a higher moral standard. So let's talk now about the First Amendment and religious freedom in general. That's really the crux of this issue. And remember that the First Amendment has more than just a protection of religion. It also protects four other aspects of our conscience: assembly, petition, press, and speech. And I use the little acronym RAPS, R-A-P-P-S, to help me remember that. As James Madison was drafting the what became the First Amendment, he wrote his original wording: "The civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established, nor shall the full and equal rights of conscience be in any manner or on any pretext infringed." That was Madison's original idea behind the First Amendment. And when that passed the House and went over to the Senate combined it with several other proposed amendments and sent it back. And now we've got this First Amendment that covers quite a bit of territory, much beyond religious freedom itself. But notice one of, two things stand out in Madison's original draft. They were intent on avoiding any national religion. Now, this was because there were, at that time, many Christian denominations in America, and Jews were present, Mohammedans were present, and so to establish a national religion would probably have required maybe 60-70% of the nation to feel obliged to change their religion, and that just wasn't going to work. And but nevertheless, when the First Amendment was drafted, it clearly enjoined Congress and Congress alone. The state governments were completely free to have religions, established religions, and at least nine of them had religions. Connecticut didn't disestablish their religion of Congregationalism until 1818. So at the state level, a established religion was considered just fine by most people. Yes, Madison and Jefferson were successful in getting the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom passed and disestablishing the Church of England in Virginia. But remember this, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom begins with these words: "Whereas Almighty God hath created the mind free," and then it goes on. So still, you can see the emphasis here is on conscience, on having the freedom to believe what you want to believe and act on that. So it's all about freedom of conscience. And as we know, the Constitution might not have actually been ratified if the Bill of Rights had not been added, that is. The first big test it faced was in Massachusetts after five quick
ratification, and then Massachusetts was probably not going to ratify it. At least a straw poll indicated that, and it was only due to the Federalists promising the Anti-Federalists that they could put some amendments in and proposed articles for Bill of Rights that caused the Anti-Federalists to come on board and ratify. And if Massachusetts had not ratified, it's possible Virginia might not have ratified. And if both those states had not ratified, New York certainly would not have. It only passed in New York by 3 votes. And so we might not have had the Constitution were it not for the promise of a Bill of Rights. So that Bill of Rights is quite important, not only for the protections that it secures, but for probably giving us the Constitution to start with. Now, one of the problems we face today is our increasingly pluralistic society. But in 1791, this was not a case. America in 1791 was a Christian nation. The Bible, if not the primary textbook, it was at least the secondary textbook in every American school. The founders, with a few notable exceptions, were all Orthodox Christians, even if they came from a variety of denominations. And even those that were not 100% Orthodox understood the connection between morality and successful Republican government. They knew that public morality had to be encouraged, even enforced, by government in order to keep the Republic, as Franklin charged. In his notes on Virginia, Jefferson wrote, "And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God?" Declaration of Independence signer Charles Carroll wrote, "Without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. They, therefore, who are decrying the Christian religion, whose morality is so sublime and pure, are undermining the solid foundation of morals, the best security for the duration of free governments." Even our first president, George Washington, had much to say on this. He said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Religion and experience, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that the national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles." So many other statements like these show us that the founders believed that morality and religion both were strong partners in a free government. They, in fact, were the reason that government could remain free. Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story thought, "Government cannot long exist without an alliance with religion." So that makes it pretty clear that there had to be some connection. Yet that connection was pretty much disestablished in 1947 with the Everson versus Board of Education opinion, which gave us the infamous wall of separation metaphor that they yanked out of a letter of Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist. And we've been struggling with that wall ever since. If you look at Jefferson's letter, first look at the letter the Danbury Baptist sent him, but then look at Jefferson's full reply, you see that his focus was on keeping government out of religion, not the other way around. That government was supposed to stay out of the affairs of the church and stay out of the affairs of conscience. He, in fact, mentions this. Rights of conscience were important to him in his reply. So we need to keep that in mind. It wasn't to keep church out of the government. It was to keep government out of the church. If you separate religion and morality from government, you're going to fail that government. So now, Kim Davis believes that it is, in fact, her Christian duty to not issue these marriage licenses. So is that a religious activity, really, issuing marriage licenses? If we look at 1 Corinthians 10:31, it says, "Whatever you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." Do it all for the glory of God, whatever you do. So is driving to work an exercise of your religion? Well, to the Christian, it is. Would God prefer you to stay under the speed limit, or does it not matter to him? Ask that question. Is deciding whether or not to take time in the day for Bible study or religious is that a religious activity? Well, to the Christian, yes. Is deciding whether to obey the Kentucky Constitution or a Supreme Court opinion, is that a religious activity? To a Christian, it is, because all activity is done to the glory of God and in accordance with his standards. So deciding whether or not to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple, which will give official sanction to what the Bible does not recognize as a marriage, is certainly a religious activity, and I think Kim Davis would agree. So that's my view of the First Amendment and religious freedom. I think we have one caller on the line. Let's go to David in Hampton, Virginia. David, what is your comment or question?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Gary. Dave Dietrich. Great show this morning. I just have a three-part question.
Okay, speak up, David. At least I'm having a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry. I don't know why that is. I can't hardly hear you all of a sudden either.
Speak up.
Fairly loudly. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you well enough. Go ahead.
Okay. So, first part of the question. Since the Obergefell ruling says that no longer recognizes the sanctity of true marriage, how quickly do you think it will transition to marriage can be between a man and two women, a man and a dog, or a man and an automobile? So that's the first part of the question. Second part, Article 2, Section 2, gives the judicial power to the Supreme Court, extending to all cases, law, and equity arising under this Constitution and laws of the United States. How does that not include ruling on marriage? And then the third part is Article 1, Section 1, all legislative powers within the legislature, so they're the only ones authorized by the Constitution to make law. How is it that the Supreme Court has become a lawmaking body and is accepted as a lawmaking body? That's it. Thanks.
Gary, I could address the last question and perhaps Phil and
Yeah, go ahead, Dave. Take the last one there.
But that last question, it's absolutely true. The legislature alone makes law. Look at the top of a piece of legislation. It will say an act or a bill. They alone make law. Look at the head of any Supreme Court opinion, and it says it's an opinion of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court and any other court only issues opinions, and those opinions are actually, legally speaking, only binding on the parties that have come into the case before the court. So, example, Roe v. Wade only bound Roe and Wade. That's our founders' understanding of the role of courts. And therefore, courts do not make law because law is a general rule that everyone is obliged to abide by. Courts are only making a ruling about binding the parties that have come into the courtroom before them. This has changed in the evolution, the wrong evolution in the wrong direction of our legal system to basically make the Supreme Court the supreme branch of government. It is not legally the supreme branch. It is an equal, a co-equal branch with the other two, and its job has nothing to do with making law. So Americans have bought the lie that had been promulgated in the media and in the education, or I should say a miseducation system, to believe that courts make law. Courts do not make law, and by the way, there was no law requiring Kim Davis to issue these marriage licenses. No law in the state of Kentucky, no law from the federal legislature requiring her or any other clerk in any county to issue marriage licenses. It was a bold move on the part of the Supreme Court to declare that their opinion bound everybody in the country. They are wrong, and they should be impeached for their wrong rendering of this opinion.
Well, I agree completely, and as Phil Duffy pointed out in the case of Wisconsin in 1854, the Supreme Court's opinion only has the force that we give it. And Wisconsin certainly wasn't going to give the Supreme Court's opinion in 1854 the force of law, and they bit their heels and did not do so. Dave Dietrich also mentioned the aspects of where is this decision going to go potentially, and if you read the Obergefell decision and the reasoning of Justice Kennedy, which Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts says has nothing to do with the Constitution, then you can see that other forms of marriage can't be denied. They're based on the understanding that marriage is nothing more than a self-fulfillment, then polygamy is the laws against polygamy are going to have to come down if you can continue that reasoning to its logical conclusion. And other forms of marriage will have to be allowed as well. It would be inconsistent to apply that opinion in any other way. Now, the Supreme Court, even in 1842, recognized that they don't really create law. in Swift v. Tyson. They said, in the ordinary use of language, it will hardly be contended that the decisions of courts constitute laws. They are at most only evidence of what the laws are and not themselves laws. They are often reexamined, reversed, and qualified by the courts themselves whenever they are found to be either defective or ill-founded or otherwise incorrect. So the opinion of Obergefell should be reversed because it was defective, it was ill-founded, it was incorrect, and the court should take action to reverse that themselves. If they don't, then we the people have the decision of whether to give it effect or not to give it effect, and to encourage our states to do likewise through their own action. Phil Duffy, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that strikes me is this idea of legal precedence and how much import has been attached to that. That was not always the case. It seems to me that if you look back at our history, that the basic idea was that the Constitution was the supreme law of the land, and the law schools taught that. It wasn't until the late 19th century, corresponding to the progressive movement and the importation of Prussian ideas into the United States, that the law schools started to depart from that idea and move towards this idea that there was precedence that mattered more than anything else. And so we have lawyers now who spend tons of time looking for precedence. And, of course, you can find all kinds of precedents because there's so many cases out there. You can come to almost any conclusion you want to, as opposed to the pure interpretation of the law by starting with the Constitution of the United States and perhaps adding, if there is some doubt, adding some interpretation from areas like the Federalist Essays. So I think that what we have seen here is we've seen an erosion of the original idea of the concept of law.
David, I'll address your second part of your question. You asked about Article 3. Actually, I think you said Article 2, but you meant Article 3. What is the judicial power extending to all cases in law and equity? Well, let's go back to Article Section 1 of Article 3, where it says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and on and on and on. So what is the judicial power? That is the crux of the question. If the judicial power is to render opinions as to a particular law, then that's fine. If the judicial power is to create new law or to modify existing law in such a way that it still carries the rule of law, then I think we have a problem. I don't think that's the judicial power as the framers would have intended it, nor should we give it that interpretation today. David, what do you think?
Well, I'm in full agreement with you, Gary, and what's happened is there's been a revolution in our land that began in the law schools of our land, and that revolution was this, that there was a fixed understanding that law is an absolute standard coming from the Creator who made all the laws of the universe to an evolutionary theory that law does not come from the Creator, and law is not a fixed standard, so it changes every day. And basically this theory said there's certain human beings that have the power to evolve the law, and that's not you or me or any other average individual. You got to go to law school. You got to swallow all the propaganda that they're going to feed you at law school. You got to pass the bar exam and become an approved lawyer. That is, everybody agrees in that club of lawyers that you are of the same mindset that they are in terms of where law comes from. And the ultimate thing is, once you put on a black robe, then you get to be the evolver of the law. And you get to say what law is, particularly if you get the black robe that happens to, you know, reside in that marble mausoleum there in Washington, D.C., called the Supreme Court Building. All of a sudden, you're elevated to a level of being a demigod that the whole society is supposed to bow down and worship every word that comes out of your mouth, or rather, every slip of your ink pen that you put on paper suddenly becomes the law for the rest of us. And our founders warned us, Thomas Jefferson being one, that such a theory of government, such a theory of our Constitution is not only false, it is extremely dangerous because it puts us under the tyranny of a despotic oligarchy of black robe lawyers. Those are not Jefferson's words. I'm basically paraphrasing Jefferson, but that's what we have in America today. We are under a tyranny of black robe lawyers, And this is not a constitutional republic. We can right that wrong, however, by having the legislative branch fulfill its duty and begin impeaching judges all over the land. For example, that David Bunning who put Kim Davis in jail, he should be impeached, which is the responsibility, of course, of the House of Representatives to draw up articles of impeachment. So here's one thing everyone could do. Call your representative down there in Washington, D.C., and demand that he begin filing articles of impeachment against federal judge David Bunning.
Good point. And if everybody did that, we might actually see some changes in this country. I should point out that if you're having trouble getting in on your calls, try this number, 610-539-1783 or 1784. Either one of those, 610-539-1783. Or 1784 might make it easier for you to get in. Now, Dave Dietrich is still our only caller on at the moment. So, Dave, do you have any more questions for our panel?
Before we go back to David, if I could add something here,
sure,
I would appreciate it.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, let's go back to Article 3. And now let's put it under the microscope. And, you know, let's be objective and recognize that the Constitution's not a perfect document. First of all, take a look at the care that went into Article 1. The specific powers that are granted to government are identified in Article 8 of that article. We have things that are denied to the states and so forth. There's a very, very clear division of powers between the state and the federal government. You go on to Article 2, which deals with the executive, and it's not quite as comprehensive, and we've seen some problems that have arisen out of that because we have an almost imperial executive today. But then look at the length of Article 3, which deals with the powers of the judiciary. Any way you want to measure that, the number of sections, number of sentences, the number of words, the number of ideas, whatever it is, it almost seems like an afterthought by comparison with Articles 1 and Article 2. Basically, you know, we have a problem with Article 3 of the Constitution. It does not adequately describe the powers and limitations of power of the judiciary.
And so we're going to have to change that, and that leads us to how do you amend the Constitution and another subject for another day. I see we've got one more caller on the line, Claude Dunn from Fredericksburg, Virginia. Do you have a question for us?
Hello?
Yeah, we've got you. Go ahead, Claude.
Yes, Gary. The one area that has not been brought out too strongly, I think y'all have done a fantastic job, but I know we're short on time, is the area that our nation was founded on, the idea of rejecting law that they call pretend law in the Declaration of Independence. Every aspect of our government, from the starting down to people taking oath of office to support the Constitution, every individual that is a member of government that takes an oath of office is declaring that in areas of responsibility that they have, they will declare laws null and void that do not, according to them individually, comply with the Constitution. This is uniqueness of American system of government, and if any government should be rejecting these Supreme Court justices that think they're, as David said, demagogues, it should be America. This woman should not be an exception to the rule. She should be the rule. This is what sets America apart from every other nation on the face of the planet. I'll just let you respond to that. Thank you.
Well, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you brought that up. We are, in fact, out of time. Let me leave you with this saying from Ronald Reagan. Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on to them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free. So the question I'll leave you with till next week is, are you willing to fight for your children's and your grandchildren's freedom? If not, who will? See you next week.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.